Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscowain. It was a surprise hearing in more ways than one. The Select Committee on January 6th called a last-minute session yesterday to share new information about the attempts to overthrow and overturn the 2020 election. The star witness, Cassidy Hutchinson, the 25-year-old former aide to Trump's chief of staff, Mark Meadows. Hutchinson's job put her in Trump's inner circle and gave her a close-up view of the tumultuous final months of his presidency. Under questioning from GOP Vice Chair Liz Cheney, Hutchinson described a president desperate to hang on to power at any cost, a chief of staff unwilling to challenge him, and aides who tried desperately to avert a constitutional crisis and avoid criminal charges against the president and themselves. This hour, the testimony of Cassidy Hutchinson, the stunning revelations, and how they could potentially influence a Department of Justice investigation, plus new allegations of witness tampering from those in Trump's orbit. Joining us in studio is Lauren Uziel, professor of Temple University Beasley School of Law and a former federal prosecutor serving in the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York and later the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. Lauren, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And also joining us from Michigan is Barbara McQuaid, professor from practice at the University of Michigan Law School and former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. Barbara, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks very much for having me.
So, Lauren, let me begin with you, although I'd like both of you to answer this question, and it's simply what surprised you most or struck you most from the testimony that you heard yesterday?
I think the thing that struck me most was the testimony about the magnetometers and Trump's awareness of the fact that the rallygoers were armed and the type of arms. That testimony in particular was, to me, the most powerful because it was directly coming from Trump, right? Yeah. She overheard him say, I don't care that they're armed. I don't care if they have weapons. They're not here to hurt me. Take the effing mags away. And that was just, I thought, the most shocking thing that came from yesterday.
And we're going to hear some of that testimony in just a moment. Barbara McQuaid, what do you say? What struck you the most from the testimony?
Well, I thought the description of what happened at the White House after the attack on the Capitol began is also important. When Cassidy Hutchinson testified that, you know, she went to see Mark Meadows and said, you know, my gosh, they're getting inside the Capitol. The president needs to do something. Meadows was very calm and said he's already said he doesn't want to do anything. And Cipollone was pushing him, you know, the White House counsel, to say and do something and was kind of resigned to the fact that Trump wasn't going to do anything. I think it raises more questions than it answers, but it does most certainly make me, if I were an investigator, to want to talk to Meadows and Cipollone about why this was. Did Trump know that this was all part of the plan, that there was going to be an attack, and so there was no need to call it off? Did Trump decide in the moment that, hey, you know what, this is good for me. I can utilize this crowd. Maybe this will be the effort to stop. And because Donald Trump not only had the power to make a public statement that would be likely to have the effect of causing the crowd to stand down, he also had the power to call in the National Guard to physically stop it. Unlike most of us, he doesn't have just a duty not to commit bad crimes. He has a duty to assertively do things to protect the public, to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. And so his omission in that moment could also constitute a crime. So I think it raised more questions than it answered, but at least in the court of public opinion, I think we know now that Trump was even more shameful and even more unhinged than we had previously known.
Hmm. Lauren, was Cassidy Hutchinson a credible witness in your view as a prosecutor?
Absolutely. I thought she came across as someone with no axe to grind. She was very forthright about her motivations. I mean, she was a public servant and she was coming to speak truthfully and to relay the things that she had heard and the things that she had seen. And she did so without a lot of, you know, there wasn't embellishment, there wasn't drama, there wasn't, you know, it was just, this is what happened. This is what I heard. This is what I saw. She was careful. And of course, the Representative Cheney was also very good at her questioning, very careful to make clear what it was that she saw firsthand, what it was that she heard from others. And she was very direct about that. And I think she came across to me as quite sympathetic in the sense that she was a young person put into this position at the White House, seeing what she saw, and just the enormous amount of courage it took for her to come forward and do this. And she was very poised throughout the entire hearing. So I thought I found her just a really credible witness.
Barbara McQuaid, one of the things that we learned was that Cassidy Hutchinson changed lawyers at some point in this process. She was originally represented by someone who was in Trump's orbit. Is that why, do you think, she was able to be more forthcoming in her testimony than she might otherwise have been?
I think that's a possibility that, her prior lawyer was somebody who was very much part of Trump world and may have been giving her some advice that she should not reveal certain facts. And a new lawyer who is a former DOJ official and a former associate of Jeff Sessions, who may have advised her to be more candid. I also think some other things may have been happening here that caused the timing of this. There was some suggestion that she was getting either threats or some intimidating emails or messages that could have caused the committee to decide to move her testimony up from, rather than waiting several weeks before she testifies for fear that she would be the focus of continued threats or intimidation. Also, we're seeing some really interesting activity occurring at the Justice Department these days. Last week, we had the execution of search warrants to obtain the cell phone of John Eastman and the cell phone of Jeffrey Clark, as well as the serving of a number of grand jury subpoenas on some of the false electors. And so I don't know to what extent they're coordinating their activity, but it seems like it's possible. Recall that the DOJ hearing that was supposed to be scheduled for a week prior got delayed until right after those search warrants and subpoenas were served. And I can't help but wonder if that wasn't delayed at the request of DOJ, and if there isn't a little bit of back and forth going on, and perhaps a desire by the committee to get her testimony on either to avoid conflict with DOJ or the request of DOJ. So interesting how those two things might be coordinating behind the scenes.
For sure. And I do want to revisit the John Eastman conversation in a little bit as well, and Jeffrey Clark for that matter. One of the biggest takeaways, Lauren Uziel, from yesterday's hearing was that, as you mentioned moments ago, that Trump knew that his supporters, which included the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, had all manner of weapons on the morning of January 6th. They had knives, they had spears, bear spray, brass knuckles, even AR-15s were reported. But that he was more concerned with crowd size and optics, and he felt that the metal detectors, or the magnetometers, mags for short, were a hindrance to people coming in and filling the space, and he wanted those metal detectors removed. Here is how Cassidy Hutchinson described it.
But when we were in the offstage announced tent, I was part of a conversation. I was in the vicinity of a conversation where I overheard the president say something to the effect of, I don't effing care that they have weapons. They're not here to hurt me. Take the effing mags away. Let my people in. They can march to the Capitol from here. Let the people in. Take the effing mags away.
So, Lauren, I'd like you to say a little bit more about that, because you said that that was the thing that really struck you the most out of the testimony yesterday.
Well, yeah. And so I'll tell you, there are two reasons why it struck me. The first is that it was one of the few pieces of testimony she gave that she was recounting what she heard from Trump directly. Much of the rest of the testimony was coming from what she heard from Meadows, which I completely agree with Barbara, that is astounding. But it is really sort of a lead to, right? It raises more questions, as Barbara said, than it answers. It's a lead to DOJ to say, we really need to do what we can to speak to Meadows, because he knows a lot. And so that's one reason why it struck me was there was that differentiation. But then, of course, the other was what it indicated itself about Trump's mind and knowledge and intent. And I think, this was the first time that we heard evidence that Trump knew for certain that this crowd was armed. And that, I think, is something, I mean, it's tough because there's so much that comes out in the press about this, and there's so much that comes out that sort of makes people think, oh, he must have known, or he might, right? But there's a big difference between he must have and evidence that he did. And so to me, this stood out because it was, you know, as a prosecutor, if you're thinking about how to build a case, you really want to focus on what is the hard evidence I have of mental state and knowledge and intent. And this is one piece that's, I think, is important. But it alone, I think, to be clear, I don't think it's enough. But it's a really important, you know, brick in the wall, as prosecutors like to talk about, right? Building a case is like putting bricks on a wall, and this was a big brick.
And Barbara, in thinking about what the president knew and what his mental state was, as Lauren just pointed out, he was aware that the crowd had weapons. He said, "They're not here to hurt me." Knew that they were planning to march to the Capitol and was in fact planning to go along with them. Is there a case to be made there for the former president aiding the insurrection because he knew that that's where they were going? He knew that they were armed. Is there a case to be made there for helping it along?
Well, as Lauren just said, I don't know that you've got the case yet, but I do think it was a significant piece of evidence. You'd have to show that he intended for them to breach the Capitol. And I still don't know if you have evidence of that. I think we don't have evidence. I think he was extraordinarily reckless, knowing that they had weapons and fueling the flames by saying, "We're going to march in the Capitol. You've got to fight for your country. You're not going to have one anymore." Though he was careful to throw in the word peacefully, which I think he would say negates any intent to suggest that he was advocating for a use of force. But I think that this could be some very good evidence if it can be combined with other things. For example, was he or anyone in his campaign team working with the Proud Boys or the Oath Keepers, who, according to their indictment, absolutely pre-planned to attack the Capitol? This was not an organic, like, "Hey, guess what? I grabbed a shield and then I knocked down a window and then I went inside and one thing led to another." We know that they had, you know, plans, they had uniforms, they had stacks, they had cased the building that morning. They had gone there even before Trump asked them to at about 10 a.m. And so did Trump know that? We know that at least one of the members of the Proud Boys was seen with Roger Stone on January 5th and 6th, providing him with security. Did they communicate that this was all part of the plan? If so, then I think this testimony is very consistent with that, that he knew they were armed, that he was urging them down there, that he wanted to be there to continue this urging. So I don't think this, you know, makes the case, but I think it is, you know, one more piece of evidence that tends to support a theory that he was involved in this seditious conspiracy.
We are talking about the January 6th hearing, the surprise hearing from yesterday, and the stunning testimony that came from Cassidy Hutchinson. Much more to talk about on Radio Times. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about the stunning testimony from Cassidy Hutchinson at yesterday's January 6th hearing. It was something of a surprise, the hearing, because it was scheduled rather last minute. It was not on the original schedule. And the committee said that it had new evidence that it wanted to present. And we didn't know until really the very last minute who the witness would be. But that said, there was some really eye-opening testimony, and that is what we are talking about today and how it might impact a Department of Justice investigation into the events of January 6th and the efforts to overturn the 2020 election. Our guests are Lauren Uziel, who is professor at Temple University Beasley School of Law and a former federal prosecutor. Also with us is Barbara McQuaid, who is professor of practice at the University of Michigan Law School and former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. Let me just give our listeners the information to be part of the conversation here. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, or you can call us at 888-477-9499. Lauren Uziel, before we move on, as we were taking the break, we were talking about what the president knew. We were talking about the morning of January 6th, his awareness that the crowd was armed and kind of what he knew and when he knew it. And I know that there was something that you wanted to add to what Barbara was talking about around that.
Oh, so actually, it was just on the issue of the timing of her testimony. And so I absolutely agree with everything Barbara said about why we might be hearing this now. I would only add one more, which is that, you know, one thing that struck me yesterday that came out, and I think this, again, is an example of something everyone sort of thinks to themselves, well, Meadows must know a lot. But we know now for sure, Meadows knows a lot. And, you know, there's a pending referral from the committee to the Department of Justice for contempt proceeding against Meadows for not testifying. Meadows, as we know, is not cooperating at this point with the committee. And so I think that part of this and the timing of it may also have had to do with the committee's desire to sort of ramp up pressure on Meadows from a host of different directions to get him to cooperate and to testify.
If you're representing him, do you advise him to go to the committee and change his mind about things?
Well, I mean, one thing based on yesterday's hearing is I'd probably advise him to take the Fifth. So I think one of the things that will have to be teed up or might be teed up depending on what Meadows does is, you know, is DOJ prepared to consider immunity in return for his testimony?
Yeah. I want to come back to that question. We have a tweet here from one of our listeners who says Trump not only knew they had weapons before his speech telling them to fight, he knew the Secret Service felt it was too dangerous for him to go to the Capitol. And there was some discussion about that yesterday, about him wanting to go and them sort of stalling and saying, well, no, we're working on it. And then ultimately telling him no, that he could not go, which leads me to the next question, which is, and this is for you, Barbara, that we learned that day that Trump did have every intention of going to the Capitol with the rioters until his security detail pulled the plug on it. We have some sound here from Cassidy Hutchinson describing what happened when Trump's motorcade left the Ellipse after his speech that day, and she describes an exchange between Trump and Secret Service agent Bobby Engel, who told the president that going to the Capitol was out of the question.
The president had very strong, very angry response to that. Tony described him as being irate. The president said something to the effect of, I'm the effing president, take me up to the Capitol now. To which Bobby responded, sir, we have to go back to the West Wing. The president reached up towards the front of the vehicle to grab at the steering wheel. Mr. Engel grabbed his arm, said, sir, you need to take your hand off the steering wheel. We're going back to the West Wing. We're not going to the Capitol. Mr. Trump then used his free hand to lunge towards Bobby Engel, and when Mr. Renato had recounted this story to me, he had motioned towards his clavicles.
And Barbara McQuaid, again, there's an example of Cassidy Hutchinson telling us what someone told her. It was not her direct experience, but what did you make of that?
Yeah, I thought it was pretty shocking. Now, we know that some in the Secret Service have refuted that claim, but they do not refute the fact that Trump very much wanted to go to the Capitol. So whether he was reaching for the wheel or he was physically trying to express his dismay, whatever it was, he very much wanted to go to the Capitol. And I think that's the important takeaway here. And why did he want to go to the Capitol? He wanted to continue to urge on his supporters there. I suppose I'm hearing some people make the leap of, you know, he wanted to charge inside with them. I don't know that we've had proof yet that he wanted to get inside the building or that he believed it was capable for the mob to breach the building at this point. So I don't think we can reach that leap just yet. But he did very much want to be there. And so he was pushing the crowd to try to intimidate the members of Congress into changing their vote, I think, putting political pressure on them. And so I think, you know, this cuts into this idea of, you know, corruptly obstructing an official proceeding in the same way he is suggesting to witnesses that, or maybe someone is, suggesting to witnesses that, you know, he pays attention to what they say when they testify, standing outside the Capitol and screaming in the windows, "Hey, Mike Pence, you better not certify the vote." I think you could suggest is an effort to corruptly obstruct an official proceeding.
Well, since you mentioned that, let me ask this question that came in an email from Paul, who says, can your guests specify what some of the legal charges could be against Trump, Eastman, Giuliani, provided the evidence that we're seeing is solidified? So since you brought that up, Barbara, I'll let you take a crack at that and then Lauren as well.
I think that there are three potential crimes that Trump could be charged with. One is obstructing an official proceeding. That's just the very narrow interfering with the vote that day. On January 6th, Congress is supposed to certify the vote, and Trump is taking steps to make them stop. I think many of the efforts could be seen as contributing to that, including pressuring Mike Pence to just refuse to certify. That's probably the cleanest and easiest one to prove, and there may already be evidence of that. I think the next broader crime would be conspiracy to defraud the United States. That is interfering with the proper administration of the law, in this case, the peaceful transition of presidential power. I think that any of these schemes, like the alternate slates of electors, or pressuring Brad Raffensperger, or pressuring Rusty Bowers in Arizona, any one of those could be seen as conspiracy to defraud the United States, coupled with what he knew to be lies about winning the election, when in fact he knew that he had lost. I think that case already probably can be made. The third one that I think we inch closer to yesterday is a very serious one. They're all serious, but that is seditious conspiracy. And that is agreeing to use force to oppose the government of the United States. We know the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers have already been charged with that crime. If you can link Trump to that violence, he doesn't have to be there. He doesn't have to participate in it. But if he agrees that someone will use force to oppose the authority of the United States by trying to stop this vote, he could be charged with that third crime as well.
Hmm. And Lauren Uziel, do you agree with that?
I do. And the only one I would add, which I am not surprised Barbara left out because it would be the weakest one, the hardest one to bring, would be inciting a riot. And I think that would be hard because you would have to show, I mean, because of the First Amendment protections that the Supreme Court has laid out in a number of cases, the bar is really high to showing, to sort of crossing that line between what is free speech and what is actual incitement to imminent unlawful action. But it's sort of, you know, floating out there as a possibility.
Yeah. Cassidy Hutchinson also testified about how Trump reacted in December of 2020 when he learned about an interview that then Attorney General William Barr had given to the Associated Press, in which he said that he found no evidence, no appreciable evidence of any sort of election fraud. And she described hearing a noise, walking into the Oval Office dining room and seeing ketchup running down the wall. And she talked about a shattered porcelain plate on the floor and said that the valet who was cleaning up told her the president was so angry with Barr for giving that interview that he threw his lunch at the wall, and apparently that it was not the first or the only time that something like that had happened. And Barbara McQuaid, I'm asking you, given that so much of a potential prosecution does involve knowing something about Trump's mental state, how might a prosecutor interpret testimony about these kinds of incidents, especially, you know, coupled with the limousine incident and other things like that?
Well, I think it shows his desperation to cling to power, even in the face of the truth, that he was very upset about it. You know, I suppose any of us would be upset to lose an election or have our subordinates say something different from what we're willing to say. But I think it does show his desperation to cling to power was so great that he was willing to do things that are perhaps unthinkable for most of us. I think that a defense might be to try to use this to show how, in the words of William Barr, delusional he was, that he was so unhinged that it was difficult for him to form the requisite mental state. So I think there's a potential downside to all of this irrational behavior. But, you know, it's not going to amount to an insanity defense. It would just simply be because he was so, I don't know what the right diagnosis is, suffering from some narcissistic disorder, he was unable to accept the reality that he had lost. Unless he wants to go there, I think that this will just contribute to the argument that he was willing to do anything to cling to power. Hmm.
Lauren Uziel, both you and Barbara have laid out potential charges that could come out of this for Trump. What do you think is the likelihood that he is ultimately prosecuted, that he is criminally charged as a result of all of this?
I think that we have to take a step back and understand how our country sort of conceives of this issue of prosecuting former presidents. It is something that has never happened in the history of this country. And what is unique in this case is not only is Trump a former president, but he is a potential and some would say highly likely nominee for the 2024 election. And that really complicates the prudential analysis of whether to charge. So there's two issues, right? The first is there enough here? Is there a legal case? Can DOJ make a legal case for these crimes that we've just discussed? But then there's this question of, is this in the interests of the country? And that is a much harder question. I think because we have this history of not having done this before, that creates a high bar, rightfully so. On the other hand, this is unique. I mean, this is a situation where if we don't charge, right, that could create risks to the country's stability and democracy as well. So it's a very thorny question that will have to be sorted out. And I don't know, I don't know that at this point anyone can say for certain whether it's likely to happen or not. We just have to see. A lot will depend on how the evidence comes out, what the strength of the evidence is. Because, of course, as the strength of the evidence gets stronger, it becomes harder to turn away.
We have been talking about yesterday's testimony at the hastily arranged January 6th hearing. Cassidy Hutchinson was the star witness. She was a former aide to Mark Meadows, President Trump's chief of staff. That is what we're talking about. This is Radio Times, and you are listening to WHYY in Philadelphia. And Barbara McQuaid, I just want to follow up on what Lauren was saying, because I think for the average person who is not a lawyer, who is watching these hearings and watching the committee sort of lay out their case, the average person might say, well, my goodness, how much evidence do you need to bring charges? And as you've been explaining, it's, you know, there's more to it than that. But I think that there is a population of people that is watching this and saying, my goodness, how much does it take?
Yeah, so, you know, we have to begin with the premise that in our country, we have a system that is designed on the premise that it is better that 10 guilty people go free than that one innocent person be convicted. And so for that reason, our system is all stacked against charging and convicting people of crimes, you know, proving guilt beyond a reasonable doubt to a unanimous jury of 12 people is very, very difficult. And I think sometimes people don't realize that, you know, when you see a crime committed by eyewitnesses, then, you know, it's fairly easy to prove. Someone pulled the gun, they fired, they shot, they killed somebody. It's a fairly easy case. When you have a case like this that is much more about what a person intended, it is much more difficult to prove. And although we've seen some really staggering evidence in the public domain, it's very one-sided. There's been no cross-examination at the January 6th hearings. And one of the tasks of the Justice Department in proving a case is disproving the negative, because you have to always look at a case through the skeptical eye of a juror and how a defense attorney might negate your evidence. And that means you have to talk to all of the people who have knowledge about the events to find out maybe there's more to this story that we don't know. What did Mark Meadows say to Donald Trump? Gee, I feel awfully badly about what's happening on the Capitol right now. did any of that happen? Pat Cipollone, did he tell Trump things like, you won this election and we have great legal theories that can prove it? Probably not, but you need to interview all of those people to find out what the president knew, what was in his head, what was his intent. And that takes an enormous amount of time because first you want to gather all of their communications, their text messages, their emails, their documents, so that you can ask informed questions and you can confront them with those things and they can't lie to you about what they may have been thinking if you have the goods to prove otherwise. So it just takes an inordinate amount of time. It sounds like the Justice Department is now focusing on that with the search warrants of Eastman and Clark recently, that they are not simply, sitting idly by, that they are very much investigating this case just as the committee is.
In our last minute or so before we go to break, Lauren Uziel, I want to go back to what you said about Mark Meadows and legal exposure that he has. And there was a moment where Cassidy Hutchinson described him as somebody who spent a lot of January 6th scrolling through his phone, somewhat checked out. She also described an exchange that involved White House counsel Pat Cipollone, who was becoming increasingly agitated that nobody was putting a stop to the violence that day. Let's listen to that.
I remember Pat saying to him something to the effect of, the rioters have gotten to the Capitol, Mark. We need to go down and see the president now. And Mark looked up at him and said, he doesn't want to do anything, Pat. And Pat said something to the effect of, and very clearly had said this to Mark, something to the effect of, Mark, something needs to be done or people are going to die and the blood's going to be on your effing hands. This is getting out of control.
So in that testimony and throughout her testimony, Cassidy Hutchinson talked about the increasing agitation among certain staffers, and Cipollone in particular, who from that morning on was saying, please don't let him go to the Capitol. Please get somebody out there. Please intervene in all of this. We are about to go to a break in a moment. But Lauren, when we come back, I'd like you to talk about what Cipollone would be worried about in a case like that and what's going through his legal mind in that moment as the insurrection is unfolding. Again, we're talking about the testimony from yesterday's hearing, the January 6th hearing, and what came out of that. Much more to talk about when Radio Times comes right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane, and we're talking about the January 6th hearing yesterday featuring Cassidy Hutchinson. She, of course, was an aide to Trump's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, and she provided some really eye-opening testimony about what the president knew about his supporters on January 6th. She also talked about conversations that she had with her boss and various other staff members, not only on January 6th, but in the run-up to that day. Very eye-opening, lots to talk about there. Our guests are Barbara McQuaid, who is professor of practice at the University of Michigan Law School. Also with us is Lauren Uziel, who is professor at Temple University's Beasley School of Law. Before we took our break, Lauren, we played some sound where Cassidy Hutchinson was describing Pat Cipollone, then White House counsel, becoming increasingly agitated that no one was pushing the president to intervene and put a stop to the violence on January 6th. And I wanted to ask you, what would Cipollone have been worried about? What's going through his legal mind at that moment?
Yeah, I think two things. So first, as president of the United States, Trump has a duty to take care that the laws are executed, and he has a duty to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. And that means in a situation where there's a violent attack on the Capitol, he needs to do everything in his power to stop it. And so if he's not doing that, he's abdicating his oath. And then the second issue is the failure to intervene and to do something is very strong circumstantial evidence of his intent for those things to happen, right? The things that he's not stopping. And so there's both, right? I mean, again, this all comes down to his state of mind and proving state of mind, which is difficult and often only proven through circumstantial evidence. But circumstantial evidence can sometimes be very powerful. And this is an example of that, yeah. Right? His refusal to intervene would be very powerful evidence that he intended for that attack to happen.
Question from Sherry, who says, yesterday, Cassidy also talked about the threats to Vice President Mike Pence and that Trump seemed to agree with them and Meadows took no action. What does that add to the legal case? And Barbara McQuaid, she appears to be talking about the idea that, you know, the crowd was chanting to hang Mike Pence. And Cassidy Hutchinson said that Mark Meadows said, Trump says he deserves it. How do you answer Sherry's question?
Yeah, you know, we are so caught up in federal offenses about obstructing an official proceeding and seditious conspiracy and the like that we may be ignoring a very simple question of, you know, the physical. Now, if Mike Pence had been killed by that mob, I think one could make an argument that Donald Trump had contributed to that in terms of, you know, a manslaughter by failing to intervene when he had the ability to do so, knowing that the crowd was there. Now, because he didn't die, you can't have an unintended, you can't plan an unintended event like a manslaughter. But I think in terms of just the moral reprehensible nature of what he failed to do that day, you know, cannot be overstated. But I do think that Lauren's point is a very good one, which is, this is more evidence of his intent that, you know, this attack was all something that he was enjoying, that he enjoyed seeing. And was that because he knew that this was the plan, that this was pre-planned and it puts him, you know, starkly in the middle of a conspiracy? Or instead, did he see it as a wonderful opportunity? Like, huh, look at that. They made it in the door. And now they're saying, hang my pants. Well, he deserves it. Let's see what happens. Could that be part of his effort to obstruct an official proceeding when he has the ability to stop it and he fails to do so?
Yeah.
So I think either way, it is some evidence of additional crime. But let's not lose track of the fact of just how morally reprehensible it is that he has the power to stop this mob and declines to do so, knowing that Mike Pence's life is in danger.
Well, and that brings me to an email from Mark. And Mark's email goes to something that you said just a few minutes ago here, Lauren. Mark says, it is a much greater risk to our democracy and to the preservation of our rule of law if Trump is not criminally charged. Otherwise, it will be evident to the world that in our nation, powerful, rich, famous people can be, quote, above the law. And he says in all caps, this is not a hard decision. We must stop being gentle with a former president and fearful of his wrath or the anger of his supporters. We must recognize the necessity to enforce the law to uphold blind justice. How do you respond, Lauren?
Yeah, and I think that I absolutely understand that view. And I think that it's incumbent on us as a country also to, you know, there's oftentimes this sort of trope that's used, like, we're not one of these countries that prosecutes our former leaders. Well, you know, France is one of those countries. South Korea is one of those countries. Israel is one of those countries. All of these are you know, relatively longstanding democracies that have, right, that we think of now as, you know, liberal democracies that have done that, that have taken that step. And, you know, that's just, I think it's incumbent on us to think about, in a broader sense, how other countries have dealt with this and whether it is something that we should be so averse to as we have historically been. That said, again, I think it is uniquely problematic that Trump is a potential runner in the 2024 election. Mm-hmm. I think that really complicates this in ways that you didn't have in those other countries.
And does that put time pressure on the DOJ potentially, knowing that the next election is not all that far away and candidates will start announcing their intentions to run?
Yeah. And I wonder what effect it will have on Trump's decision as well, because he must know that announcing a candidacy is going to be protective of him in some way, in the sense of providing sort of almost that further dissuading to DOJ. And so I don't know. We'll just have to see how it all plays out.
Yeah. On the afternoon of January 6th, after the rioters had breached the Capitol and overwhelmed the police, forced the evacuation of Congress, they threatened to hang Mike Pence, as we just mentioned a moment ago, Trump put out a tweet that said, in so many words, Mike Pence did not have the courage to do what needed to be done, namely to use his authority to overturn the election. And Barbara McQuaid, that tweet was the last straw for some of his staff members who resigned shortly thereafter. I'd like to play a little bit of sound about how Cassidy Hutchinson described that and how she felt about it.
As a staffer that works to always represent the administration to the best of my ability and to showcase the good things that he had done for the country, I remember feeling frustrated, disappointed, and really, it felt personal. It was really sad. As an American, I was disgusted. It was unpatriotic. It was un-American. We were watching the Capitol building get defaced over a lie.
Barbara, as you were watching that testimony yesterday, what was going through your mind when she talked about that tweet and just kind of that defining moment?
Well, I thought, you know, we had somebody saying the emperor has no clothes, who was actually a member of Trump's inner circle in the White House, which I thought was very refreshing. And I wonder if, you know, now that maybe the spell will wear off on some others who seem to have drunk the Kool-Aid, to say, oh, my gosh, she's right. That once exposed, it's difficult to continue to perpetuate the lie. But I think that she points out very starkly that while our Capitol is under siege, Donald Trump is throwing fuel on the fire. And I think that is, again, some very good evidence that he wanted to obstruct that official proceeding. And I think, again, it's not the whole case, but it's a really important piece of evidence, the timing of that tweet. And I really want to hear more about what happened right after that tweet with Meadows and Cipollone asking the president to call off the mob or send in the National Guard, because his failure to do those things also, I think, tends to show his mindset was that this is something he very much wanted to happen.
Kyle asks, there's been a lot made about people asking for pardons. It came up again yesterday that Meadows asked for one, but that can that factor into criminal cases? Lauren, so there was some mention of that, of Meadows asking after the fact for a pardon. We had heard from previous hearings that there were other people who had asked for pardons almost preemptively. What do you say to Kyle's question?
Absolutely. So it's evidence of consciousness of guilt, which is, again, circumstantial evidence of state of mind. And consciousness of guilt evidence is as well can be very powerful. I mean, this is evidence that the people who are requesting pardons felt that they needed one, because you wouldn't need a pardon unless you thought that you had some criminal exposure. And really more than that, unless you thought you had committed a crime. The other thing it is, in addition to being evidence of consciousness of guilt of the people who requested the pardons, is it's further evidence of a communication to Trump that there was illegality here. Now, we've heard from a number of people in the prior hearings as well that Trump had been clearly told this is not lawful, right? This is not. Now, there's a difference, of course, between, right, there's some distance to travel between this idea of Trump was told and Trump therefore accepted what he was told and knew himself this was unlawful. But again, it's just one more piece of evidence that he was told in many different ways, including this way, including the fact that people who were involved in this with him believed that this was criminal and wanted a pardon for it.
Barbara, there was a moment yesterday when General Mike Flynn's name came up. In fact, a couple of occasions his name came up. And in one case, the video that the committee played showed him pleading the Fifth over and over again, including in response to one question that Liz Cheney posed to him, and the question was whether he believes in the peaceful transfer of power. And he took the fifth on that question. What did you make of that, coming from a former general?
Yeah, it was a really astonishing moment. You know, I never begrudge anyone for invoking their Fifth Amendment rights against self-incrimination. We live in a system that is adversarial, not inquisitorial. But, you know, that wasn't a fact about were you at location X or, you know, did you do fact Y? It was, do you believe in the peaceful transfer of presidential power? To take the fifth on that suggests that his answer would tend to incriminate him. So the only answer that would incriminate him is if he said no. And for that reason, I found it really, truly astonishing. Now, maybe he was just of a mindset that I'm going to say the fifth for everything because I'm not going to help you in any way. But he paused, like he was thinking through, like, huh, this could be used against me when I answer this. So I better invoke the fifth here. I think really astonishing, incredibly unpatriotic.
Hmm. Well, this is Radio Times, and you are listening to WHYY in Philadelphia. And also, in thinking about some of the things that came up, Lauren, I'll direct this to you. We've mentioned John Eastman a couple of times in this conversation, and we know that his cell phone was seized. Barbara mentioned that Jeffrey Clark as well, that his devices were seized in a raid on his home. Can you remind us who these gentlemen are and explain what the Justice Department might be looking for here?
Yeah, so... Jeffrey Clark was an attorney at the Department of Justice in the Environmental Division. He was an environmental law attorney. And he was introduced, we have now learned from the last hearing before Ms. Hutchinson, the hearing before, he was introduced to the president through Representative Perry from Pennsylvania and approached the president and suggested that he was willing to write a letter to approached the president and suggested that he was sort of on board with an idea of writing a letter to the Georgia Secretary of State and essentially saying that the Department of Justice believed that there had been fraud in Georgia and that a new slate of electors should be appointed. And Trump, we learned from the last hearing, got in his mind that maybe he should fire the acting attorney general and replace him with Clark. And we learned again that this was a plan that, you know, ultimately didn't come to pass, basically because of the courage and the fortitude of the acting attorney general and those under him at the Department of Justice, who told Trump that there would be, you know, hundreds of resignations at the Department of Justice if this came to pass. So that's Clark. And then Eastman is Trump's, you know, sort of a, seems like a hanger-on sort of erstwhile legal advisor to Trump that was behind much of these plans and ideas of different ways to use leverage points in our system to try to reverse the outcome of the election.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting, from what I've read in the press, the search warrants on Clark and Eastman are actually, this is all part of an Inspector General's office investigation into Clark. So that's the Department of Justice Inspector General.
Yeah. I want to read a couple of comments quickly from our listeners. Jim says, for Nixon, they had the tapes, but in this case, it's just one brave young woman, and I imagine a bunch of powerful men will just refute her testimony. There is also a Facebook comment here from Virginia who says she, meaning Cassidy Hutchinson, is a brave young woman. I fear for her safety after this public testimony. Barbara McQuaid, we are just about out of time. 20 seconds or less as we go into the next round of hearings in July. What are you listening for?
Well, I think the one thing that's missing is connecting Trump up to the mob violence in terms of intent. I will be looking for that. Liz Cheney has hinted that they have that evidence, and I'd really like to hear it.
Yeah. Lauren, 15 seconds.
I'll be looking for even more evidence about all that he did not do. when the violence was occurring, which also Cheney has indicated we're going to hear more about.
Yeah, much more to come with those hearings. There are more scheduled for July. And of course, we will be covering all of that here at WHYY and keeping our listeners on top of all of those developments as they happen. Let me take a moment to thank our guests, Lauren Uziel, professor at Temple University's Beasley School of Law, and Barbara McQuaid, professor of practice at the University of Michigan. Thanks so much to you both for being on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Our producers at Radio Times are Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler, and our engineer today was Adam Stanishevsky. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane, and you are listening to Radio Times on WHYY.